Welcome back for part two of the Strange Horizons interview with Maggie Hogarth. Remember, this is part two. If you have not heard part one, this might not make much sense. I think that's all the intro we need. We'll get right back to the interview. Thanks. Well, as we're talking, there's this whole set of parallels that I'm thinking of, and if I come out a little inarticulate, I am actually thinking this through kind of for the first time. But these parallels between how these kinds of distribution models might affect fiction writing. And I'm seeing this in a parallel to the proliferation of sort of MP3s and the music industry. Because when you talk about the people, you know, the way people interact with the physical object of the book, and I think there's very clear parallels there. Because, I mean, you know, people like me who prefer mass market paperbacks and will, you know, treat them very badly and kind of, you know, I don't write in them or bend corners, but I do pretty much everything else that freaks out people who are more sort of cherishy about the books. You know, and I'm the equivalent of the person who, you know, would get music on back when cassette tapes were still the thing, get it on tape and sort of play the tape until it wore out. And then you have the people who are very into, in a much more meaningful way, into the book as an object. And, you know, the people who buy special, you know, collector's edition hardcovers and keep them in, you know, very pristine alphabetical order on their shelves and don't let people touch them if they don't trust them. And these are like the people who are like the obsessive vinyl collectors with records. And those people are always going to be there. You know, they're not going to go away. But the majority of consumers are perfectly happy to ditch the physical media and have the music on the computer when they can listen to it whenever they want. You know, I've read a lot of stuff about how digital music and the idea of downloading MP3s or even just transferring music off of your CDs onto your computer and getting rid of the whole downloading and copyright issues, putting all your music onto MP3s on your computer, it changes the structure. I mean, the way of thinking about an album as a constructed unit is starting to change because people don't listen to it that way anymore. All the sort of remixing and mashup and so on with music has obvious parallels to things like fan fiction.
Well, before we want to go back to the concept of the medium shaping the art, but there's one thing about music that I think is important, one important difference, because this is something that's true also of art as well as music. I mean, you always have the people who want the original. They want the actual piece of paper that an artist touched with the brush. They want to feel the texture. They want to smell the paint on it. You know, that it matters to them that it's a unique object. You know, they're not your consumers for the $10 reproduction that came off your printer. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who are going to pay you $1,000 to take home that thing which you connected with physically.
Right.
So in art, it's very similar to writing. But music, there's an issue with music in that because MP3s are so popular, when you talk about the quality of music, you don't need to record the original at a very high fidelity in order to get those copies. If you get to the point where most music is being bought at a low fidelity, then there's no reason to record it at a high enough fidelity for audiophiles who really do care about this thing. That, I think, is going to be a huge loss.
I get, but that is one aspect of the problem that then, I guess, doesn't apply to fiction, because there's not that kind of parallel to recording quality.
Yeah, we're lucky that way.
I mean, there's also the kind of use function is different. I mean, the way people interact with music, the way your average, you know, internet MP3 consumer interacts with music is probably different than the way most people interact with prose, in that it's something you can have in the background while you're doing other things. And I think that's the... Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I mean, I don't think, you know, fiction really can't occupy that place.
No. And so to return to your original point, I think there's an inevitability, I guess, that with any medium you have, the medium is going to shape the kind of art that you make. And this new medium of, like, distribution, you know, electronically to people who are consuming it daily in small bits, it makes it a very different, way to communicate art. And I think the ways that people are going to, I don't know what those ways are yet. You know, I think everyone is, can't say everyone. I think some people are experimenting with what does that mean? What can I do as a digital writer,
right,
so to that I couldn't do as a paper writer.
Right. To jump off from that a little bit. I mean, that's something that we're struggling with is such a strong word for this, but it's something we think about from time to time at Strange Horizons is, there must, what can we do as an online publication that we couldn't do as a print publication? And there are a couple of very easy sort of operational answers to that. We can make corrections to pieces after they've been published, things like that. But I don't, we know that we haven't really fully explored our possibilities there, and we would like to, but it's a question there isn't an easy answer to.
No, but this is like such an interesting topic to be an artist at this time is exhilarating and terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, you absolutely, you can hide in the corner and say, no, I'm going to do the same thing I've been doing all my life. And if you're lucky, you'll be able to get away with that. But I don't know how much longer it's going to last,
Yeah.
really.
Well, and that's and you're one of the few people I know who's really actively investigating some of these other options. Not just looking at what's going on and thinking about how it might affect things, but actually going out and playing around with it. And so.
I'm in a peculiar position in that I don't have very much to lose, in that I don't have an investment in the existing establishment.
Right.
And I have a lot of material, and I have a lot of fans. I don't know how that happened. Somehow, without the middle part where you get published by, people who make your work available to, normal bookstores and something like that,
Right.
I managed to get a following of really cool people
Right.
who are very active. So I have a readership, and I have material, and I have no reason not to try it.
Right.
So it's been pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I think it really helps you to realize that, the people who read you are real people, and they're neat people for the most part. And it's not like you're in a garret somewhere, as this tormented self, self-consuming artist that never sees the light of day.
Right.
To actually be out and about and actually feel like you know some of the people who give you some of your livelihood back. And there's a problem there, which is that this can backfire.
Right.
You can create a web presence that makes people not want to come near you or buy your books or have anything to do with you.
This is very true.
And I've actually run into three or four writers where I like their work, but I have $12, I can buy two books. I'm going to go buy the two books by readers who didn't offend me or make me feel like, why the heck am I giving them money?
Right.
So you can do this badly, and it's a risk, but
Yeah.
I don't think you can, I don't think the third alternative of pretending that the internet doesn't exist and you don't have to do any of this stuff, I don't think that's a good idea either, because you go and you say, I want to learn more about this author, and you type their name in a search engine, you get nothing. You're going to move on.
Right.
It's a hard world. It's like, I was talking to someone about how when TV came out, TV was very good for people who were photogenic and good on camera and friendly and affable, and it was very bad for people who were talented but taciturn.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And it's the same thing that's happening with the internet. The internet is very, very good for people who are gregarious and friendly and good at social networking and not very kind to people
Yeah.
who are not.
This is true. I wanted to, this is again something I'm kind of feeling my way through, and it's a little bit of a jump from what we've been talking about, and I'm not sure it's something that you're gonna really feel prepared to answer. But something else that I'm curious about in the sense of, where fiction is happening or where creative product is happening and the sort of relationship between writer and audience and so on. One of the things that interests me a lot that I want to explore more is the way that this kind of narrative, and particularly genre narrative, intersects with the gaming world. And I know you have sort of background as a player in RPGs and online games, and I know you've also done some artwork for gaming companies. But I just know, do you have any sense of the role that gaming is playing, that games are playing in this sort of narrative creation kind of world?
Oh, I think that we're not taking better advantage of it, is what I think. But the problem, see, here's the problem with gaming. Gaming is like the movie industry. in that it requires so much money and so many people working together to produce one single product that it's much harder to get a washback where you know people are smoothly interacting with different, because the video gaming market is really the power there. You know, it's not like, oh, tabletop gaming is taking off or something, you know.
Right.
It's not about, you know, tabletop or card games or anything, though they are popular. They're just, but the power is in the, oh, you know, we're playing, you know, a video game, we're playing World of Warcraft, we're, you know,
right,
the huge games that take hundreds of people to put together.
Right.
And those things, because they require so much capital and so much investment, are always going to have what is basically like a New York publisher involved with them. They're going to have a company with trademarks, with very specific protection against, you know, people participating in any way that they don't want it.
Right.
So I think it's awesome that, say, there are gaming novels. You know, I have nothing against media tie-ins. I think that can be very cool. The problem being, you know, quality. Quality is not often.
Right.
You know, it's more about the subject matter than it is about whether it's well done or some of them are well done. Some of them just aren't. And you read them because you want to read about the gaming world.
Right.
So the issue that I find with that is to get on the top of it, you have to be, you know, the person who starts the company, who has the trademarks, because otherwise, you know, until technology gets better, single people or small groups of people are not going to have as much luck creating a huge phenomenon like EverQuest or whatever.
Right. But I was saying, even the you know, Blizzard encourages on the World of Warcraft site the you know, they have their sort of sanctioned gallery of fan art, which
is true.
Not all of which is great, but some of it is kind of impressive. And more to the point, it's all, you know, stuff drawing on their copyrighted world that they're encouraging people and sort of showcasing people who are playing around in to some extent.
I was having a great conversation with this girl who actually does discussions about gaming and women and gaming and family, and she goes and speaks at conferences about it. And we were talking about how being able to place yourself in something is a great way to make it popular. So, for instance, Mercedes Lackey, what kind of herald were you? Or, you know, Anne McCaffrey, what color dragon did you ride? Harry Potter, what house are you in?
Right.
You know, the thought that you can put yourself into a world as part of a group identity and still be yourself.
Right.
And interact with all these other people who also have that shared context.
Right.
And gaming is just like that. You know, there's the solo player model where you buy a game, and then that's kind of like books with, you know, alienation themes. You are the single unique hero. You are the fish out of water, you know.
Right.
You are the one. You are Neo, you know.
Right.
But then you have multiplayer online games, which are basically like that. I am one of many.
I am Adrena.
But I am myself.
Right.
You know? And I have this group context.
Yeah.
And so when you have, like, books that have that built into them, would make great games.
Yeah.
Just interesting questions about self-insertion and interactivity, really.
Yeah. One thing that I was very struck by with World of Warcraft is how much narrative is kind of embedded in the game. And it's completely possible to run through the game without paying attention to any of the narrative. And I would have assumed that that's how most people interacted with it. Until this is about to get very geeky, but I mean until they announced the details of the Burning Legion expansion. when the World of Warcraft message boards, which are packed full of, as far as I can tell, you know, obsessive 16-year-olds, right, who you would think didn't care at all about the story, all of a sudden just erupted in this outrage over, I can't even remember the detail, over something about what the backstory assigned to one of the new races and how it completely contradicted all of the existing, you know, lore in the world. And that was a moment for me of like, they really are paying attention to the story. Maybe not on a detail level, but the narrative is part of what they love about this game.
Well,
probably the cool gear is more of what they love about the game. But yeah, all these people who I would have thought were in it for the beating stuff up with swords kind of mode, actually cared, what the origins of the Blood Elves are.
Well, in World of Warcraft, Blizzard did a few things right that I think some of the other people who are writing games like this don't necessarily do, which is they're not skirting the uncanny valley, They don't try to make things look super realistic. And they put humor in it.
A lot of
It
humor
doesn't
in
take itself very seriously. It has story, but the story is not like it's a thing that lets you laugh as well as be unnerved, which sometimes it manages. But people do pay attention to the story. And if they didn't want the story, they'd go off and play Doom. And, they've written Doom novels, and I don't know how good they were, but there's outlets already for, single player type things. But I think as human beings, we want to create context. And the more context exists, I think the more comfortable we are living there. Oh, they did a great job. I mean, I can't really play very often, but every time I play, I reflect on the fact that what a thing they made. This is like a huge creative endeavor that almost no one is going to notice outside the gaming community because it's a game.
It's not going to be taken seriously by, the mainstream creative establishment.
But it's incredibly visual. Some of the visuals are incredibly beautiful. The story, there have been better stories, but there have certainly been worse stories. And the thing that people overlook when you're talking about a 9 million subscriber game is you can't just write a single book and have it take care of it. No. This is the equivalent of like 16, 17 books with all of the behind the scenes stuff that, well, I had to figure out the way that magic worked like 16 years ago before this happened because it, briefly shows up in this book. Every single detail has to be paid attention to. I mean, the little gray, stupid objects that drop that are worth nothing that you sell back to some dwarven woman in some dwarven city has to have a name and a reason to be dropping off this particular thing that you killed. That's a lot of work.
And
Seriously.
yeah,
And
and they put that work in, which is
to get to the point where even, 3 years later, people will, kill something, pick up something that came off of its body, and then start laughing because it's funny or it's creative. I think people underestimate the amount of work it takes,
it's a
creative
ma-
work it takes.
I was gonna say it's a massive creative undertaking and has
It's
been a
like a
successful
serial
one.
that never ends, that people can explore even in the corners you don't want them to look in.
And that's interesting too, because I think in the I hate using the word traditional because I don't know enough historically about like where this idea of the tradition comes from, but in what I think many people today think of as the traditional model of the artist, that the most valuable labor is the work that you're doing completely independently for your own, to serve no master but your own vision kind of thing. And stuff like this interactive model, I keep coming back to the way you, the selling of the aphorism series on the blog, but I mean something like that, or something like whoever this creative team is writing this story content for Blizzard. This kind of work I think is seen as kind of deprioritized there, less impressive in that sort of model. But I think that's very unfair.
Oh, well, and I think at some point people are going to start understanding that this thing that they shucked off is, okay, this belongs to juveniles and is, something that people do for, who aren't grown up, do for fun. At some point, they're just going to turn around and say, whoa, when did games become this big thing? And it's not that it just became this big thing, it's that they just didn't notice. It's like, where's the Hugo for best game? Where's the Nebula for the best game? I mean, some of the most interesting, or at least a lot of science fiction and fantasy, certainly, is coming out through games. Who is going to sit back and say, oh, well, the storyline for BioShock was pretty impressive? But seriously, it was a thoughtful work that nobody's going to, nominate for a Nebula. Well, I don't know why. It was a story.
But it's a non-traditional format, so people don't know what to do with it yet. At least people within the science fiction community, people in the mass market know exactly what to do with it.
Yeah, they buy it
Exactly.
in huge numbers. And isn't that what we complain about in the genre? You know, there's not enough money to go around. Okay, between manga and anime and gaming and the movie industry, I don't know what your problem is with thinking there's no money in science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah, yeah.
We're just not selling it in the right way somehow.
Yeah. That's my kind of ongoing hobby horse with the industry is I have no patience for anyone who says science fiction is dying, because even if science fiction, even if science fiction print media as a narrowly defined market or industry is having significant troubles, that area may be struggling. Science fiction as a thing is thriving and flourishing out in the world. It's just, it's not necessarily all taking the form of digest-sized print magazines anymore, which, you know, I love the digest-sized print magazines, but the industry changes. And
but what is that? What is this fixation on the vessel instead of the idea? I mean, it's not the point. The point is not to have a magazine. The point is to have stories. You know, I have great, nothing but sympathy for people like me who, you know, they write, they draw, they do something creative. They just want to write or draw or do their creative thing. They don't want to have to worry about how it's going to be sold or whether it's possible to sell it or that they have to sell it in a different, you know, they just want to do it.
Right.
I don't have to think about any of this stuff.
Right.
I, you know, I find it interesting just because it's become an interest of mine. But I completely sympathize with writers who wish that things would just settle down already so that they can stop having to worry about it.
Yeah.
But it hasn't yet. I don't know. I'd kind of like to have a physical novel on a shelf at some point. That would be, strangely, after all this time, that's still something that, I don't want to say it's important to me, but I would enjoy, you know, to have. When I first started writing for publication, I guess that was 10 years ago, I would get together with a bunch of friends and we'd talk about all the books that we'd read lately that we liked so that, you know, we could recommend them to each other. Just the other day I was talking with them, you know, we got together after a while, and I said, so, you know, I'm looking for something to read. Have you read anything good lately? And the consensus was that none of us had picked up anything that we liked that wasn't by someone that we liked 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
We were not reading anything new. And it wasn't that we weren't trying it. It was we were picking it up, going through one or two chapters and saying, this isn't worth it. We are avid readers,
right,
you know?
Right.
So I say, well, what are you reading? And they're like, well, nonfiction or stuff online.
Right.
Well, okay then. So I think there's an uncomfortable period going going forward now.
We're in this kind of, we the broader community and industry are in a kind of transition period, and I think it's always scary and uncomfortable, and not all transitions are good, but I don't know, you can't pretend they're not happening. So we probably move towards the kind of wrapping up period.
Okay.
I don't know, is there anything else that I haven't brought up that you would like an opportunity to talk about?
You know, No, because when you told me you wanted to do this with me, I was like, why is she asking me to do this when I'm a complete and total nobody now? I mean, the last time someone who had an editor next to their title actually bought something from me in a traditional way, it's been so many years that I can't remember the last time. It's been quite a while. So I was like, wow, Strange Horizons wants to interview me. Why?
I mean it when I, you know, this isn't just for the public talk. I mean, I do mean it when I say you're one of the only people I know who's actively engaging with these questions of what's going on with the commerce models.
You know what the weirdest thing about that is?
Mm-hmm.
I hate new things. I don't think of myself as, like, the poster woman for newfangled stuff. I hate new things. I hate having to figure this stuff out. But
right.
But I'm in the middle of it. And I tell you, the real reason why is because of the people who read me and who look at my website. And, you know, at some point you just get the 600th email from someone who says, I'd love to read your book. Where can I find it? And you have to tell them, I'm sorry, my agent is still trying to sell it.
Right.
And you just can't do that anymore. I mean, some part of you just looks at the at the fact that, okay, these two things should not exist. I should not have people ready to buy my work and no one willing to take a chance on me to sell it to them. This is not a chance. I mean, but it really didn't make sense to me. And yeah. So at some point, I couldn't sustain it anymore. I couldn't do the, you know, well, I'm sorry, I can't give you anything to read because nobody will, you know, it's too weird. It's got aliens in it instead of humans. It's just, you know, something about it just isn't going, working for the people who have the money, so I right. can't give it to you.
Right.
I can't do that anymore.
Right.
I just can't.
that's understandable. And that's when you start looking for, you know, the third path, as it were.
Yeah, for a way to say, okay, you know, this is what I would have gotten out of it before, which would allow me to do more of it,
mm-hmm.
and then have you all also enjoy it. And
right.
and they said yes, and it works. So if I could figure out a way to make it work for novels, then that's what I'd be doing. But
yeah.
Not yet. haven't figured that out yet.
Right. I feel awkward asking this just after you said you haven't found many new books that you like, but I mean, the thing I've been trying to ask everyone is, you know, what's the last book you read that you liked?
The last thing I bought mm-hmm. on the Kindle was a Star Trek book.
Really?
Yes. They have all the old numbered pocket Star Trek books.
Oh, neat.
And there was one book that, you know, Kirk and Spock were in it, but they were kind of like only in 10% of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of it was about these completely original characters. And one of them was a human, and one of them was a Vulcan. And it was, and they were both girls, you know, it wasn't like a romantic thing. They were both just doing that alien first contact thing,
mm-hmm.
of trying to figure out how to be friends. And, of course, the plot happened to them and made it difficult, but
right.
that it was really, you know, a transcendent novel. It wasn't, didn't really matter that it was Star Trek. It was just a really good science fiction story.
Great.
So that was the last thing I bought, and that was Dwellers in the Crucible.
Okay. Dwellers in the Crucible. Have you, speaking of the Star Trek novels, have you read Uhura's Song by Janet Kagan?
Oh, I love Uhura's Song.
Okay.
It was so much fun.
I just found that for the first, it's the only Star Trek novel I've ever read, but I found it for the first time a couple of months ago.
It's full of furries.
Yeah.
Wait, that was the one with the one with the seals or the one with the cats?
I guess they were like cats. They were like cats.
Yes.
Yeah. It was because the author, Janet Kagan, wrote one of my favorite Christmas-themed kind of novellas. I don't even know if it was a novella. It was published in Asimov. God, it's got to be 10 or 12 years ago. And I still think of the story because I loved it so much. And it occurred to me.
Wow.
Yeah. And something reminded me of it a couple months ago. And I went looking to see what else she'd written. And came up with Uhura's Song. I was like, well, that I want to see what that's about.
That's
and it
good
was
stuff.
It was really good. It had a good sense of humor in it, and I don't know. And I thought
it was a good story. Yeah.
It was a great story, and I liked the slightly subversive thing of every single Federation person who shows up who's not sort of canonically from the Star Trek world. All of them were women.
Yeah.
every outside captain and admiral and doctor and everyone they talk to. So it's like the Federation populated entirely by women outside of the Enterprise.
Yeah, that was back when media tie-ins were almost science fiction novels, really.
Yeah.
They just happened to have characters from TV shows.
Yeah.
It's very different than it is now.
Yeah. And then I guess the other kind of standard interviewee question is, you know, so what's next for Maggie Hogarth?
Okay, well, I need to finish putting together this physical version of the Aphorisms Project, which mm-hmm. a fan donated his layout skills, which otherwise I would never have been able to afford because he's very, very good. So I need to do that. People have asked me for a sequel.
So
that's what I'm doing next year. And then after that is the interesting question, because the characters from those two projects were the reason why I started writing these shorts about them was because I was developing novel that mm-hmm. featured them,
right.
and I wanted to get to know them better.
Right.
And the novel itself kind of lends itself to not a standard novel portrayal. You know, there are letters in it. There are journal entries in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are little fables.
Right.
So I'm beginning to think maybe this is the right project to try doing an online novel of some kind.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm thinking about that. That's what I'm doing.
So, okay, well, I want to thank you for being on the Strange Horizons podcast, and
Well, thank you for having me. And I hope we, get an opportunity to maybe get together again and see how things are changing. Because
I
I would hope that things are going to get more exciting.
yeah, check back in a year or two and see what's going on with all of this. So,
That would be awesome.
okay.
Well, thank you very much.
No problem. It was great talking to you.
Okay.
Out of the, professional editing or professional podcasty sounding thing. It was, I keep saying professional. These podcasts are the least professional thing in the world. I'm not fooling anyone who's listening to
They're edited.
them. Yeah. But no, it was really good to talk to you. And that concludes the Strange Horizons podcast interview with Maggie Hogarth. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed talking to Maggie. Information about all of the things we talked about and links to Maggie's website and some of her art projects, including the aphorisms project that we talked about, are all available on the Strange Horizons website on the podcast page. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, drop us an email at podcast@strangehorizons.com. And just as a quick publishing note about the magazine, we will not be publishing new issues of the magazine during the last 2 weeks of December, but we will see you again bright and early in January. Thank you very much, and have a good new year.